This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hi, everyone, and thank you for tuning in to the 507th episode of the Hollywood Reporter's Awards Chatter podcast. I'm the host, Scott Feinberg, and my guest today is a filmmaker unlike any other. With directing credits dating back some 40 years, including 1985's Pee-wee's Big Adventure, 1988's Beetlejuice, 1989's Batman, 1990's Edward Scissorhands, 1994's Ed Wood, 2003's Big Fish, 2005's Corpse Bride, 2007's Sweeney Todd, 2012's Frankenweenie, 2014's Big Eyes, and most recently, in 2022, half of the 8 episodes that comprise the first season of Netflix's giant hit drama series, Wednesday, for which he is personally nominated for 2 Emmys, Best Directing for a Comedy Series, and, as one of the show's executive producers, Best Comedy Series. The New York Times has called him a visionary artist, noting, quote, "He has developed a singular, if not easily pinned down, sensibility. His style is strongly visual, darkly comic, and morbidly fixated, but it is rooted just as much in his affection for monsters and misfits, which in his movies often turn out to be the same thing. He all but invented the vocabulary of the modern superhero movie, brought new vitality to stop-motion animation, and has come to be associated, for better or worse, with anything that is ghoulish or ghastly without being inaccessible. He may be the most widely embraced loner in contemporary cinema." Close quote. His most frequent collaborator, Johnny Depp, who he has directed in 19 films, said that he is, quote, "a filmmaker I admire, but he's much, much more than that. Without embarrassing him, he's a true artist, which is something I wasn't sure was possible in today's cinema. But he's the real thing. He's a visionary, an auteur, totally uncompromising." Close quote. He's talking, of course, about Tim Burton. Over the course of a conversation in front of a large audience at the Burbank International Film Festival, including two of Burton's most celebrated and longtime collaborators, the composer Danny Elfman and the costume designer Colleen Atwood, the 65-year-old and I discussed his complicated childhood and how it led him to pursue drawing and attracted him to characters regarded by others as freaks, how he wound up working at Disney Animation and then making his feature directorial debut with a live-action film, the challenges of getting films made even with hits under his belt, and what ultimately led him to TV for Wednesday, plus much more. And so, without further ado, let's go to that conversation. Hello, everyone, and Tim, thank you so much for doing this. Great to see you. I normally begin every episode of this podcast asking our guests where they were born and raised, which I think we have addressed, but I do want to get into it a little bit more because, you know, over the years, you have expressed that sort of what you just alluded to, that, you know, you were very shaped by Burbank, for better or worse. There were elements that were great, elements that were complicated. Can you talk about, but one thing that you've always said is that without Burbank and without those childhood experiences, the filmmaker we know today would not exist.
Yeah.
So just break it down.
I keep reading that I hate Burbank. You know, like the press has a way of sort of taking what you say and take out the nuance and subtlety and, you know, like go right to the core. But I think, you know, and when I said about whatever I said about Burbank, it had more to do with my own psychological state of mind than it did with the actual city of Burbank. You know what I mean? So, and that's a bit too complicated and psychological to go into now. But in the sense that, you grow up in feeling a certain way, Burbank helped shape me because, you know, there was, like, my first film school was the Cornell Theater. There was this amazing theater that was torn down, I think, in the 80s. I don't know when it was, but, they would, for 50 cents, you could see a triple feature. I saw one amazing triple. I saw War of the Gargantuas, Monster Zero, and Destroy All Monsters in one go, you know, 50 cents. So that's where I learned my love of film, and that really... So there were some amazing places, and it was incredible. There was like 5 movie theaters in Burbank at a certain time, and then they all got sort of taken away. But for me, that place, especially that theater, was very, very special to me.
And you've said that during your years in Burbank, which I think up till 12 you're living at, was it Evergreen Street? Is that
where? Yeah, right down the
just
street.
Just down the street here. Then you
can all walk over there after this.
Yeah, we'll do a little
check it out.
Then you moved in with your grandmother, also in Burbank, right? But as a bit of a loner as a kid, you were kind of thinking about things, dreaming about things in everywhere from some of the cemeteries in town to
the one right next door here. You know, I used to play around there. I could look out my window. The thing that freaked me, I looked out my window at Disney, and this was like the weird, like, called the Bermuda Triangle of Burbank, because I could see where I was born at St. Joseph's, and then I could see the cemetery where all my family was buried, and I was in. So it was like a weird Bermuda Triangle that I had to escape at a certain point because it was just too scary.
Now you've also said that as a kid you were, you know, not only a bit of a loner, but sort of not particularly communicative, verbal with other people. You lived in your imagination, which manifested itself through drawing. Can we talk about how that entered the picture? And as was noted, I mean, to the extent that you were talented enough that in Burbank, your work, anti-littering art, was on the back of every garbage truck.
I won a $10, and at that time, that's probably like about $1 million now.
Right. No. But drawing was an outlet for you. What kind of things were you drawing as a kid?
Posters for trash trucks. I don't know. I mean, whatever.
But also, I mean, the movies that you were drawn to, and I believe maybe therefore some of the things you were drawing were things that other people might find frightening or scary, but that you actually, in a way, related to, right? Like, what are we talking about?
Yeah, but I mean, I didn't feel that different. It felt like, you know, I loved famous monsters. I wait for that magazine to come out. I love monster movies. I live near a cemetery. You use what you have.
Yeah,
you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So it was good.
Totally.
You know, and I think also, too, growing up in Southern California where you don't really have seasons, I think that's why I kind of got into, like things like Nightmare for Christmas or Halloween, just because it gave you a sense of occasion, a sense of season that you didn't get through the weather. You know, I mean, to experience like holidays, you had to go like to the main, like at Save On and look at the holiday displays to kind of experience.
Right. So you graduate from high school, and then there's this.
I did. Oh, I had to think about that for a minute.
We'll have to check.
Yes.
Well, no, we won't tell. But you, instead of going to a traditional college, you end up being a member of one of the first classes at CalArts, which was sort of this vision of Walt Disney. Essentially like a farm system for Disney Animation Studios. When you went there, I believe you're a class behind a guy named John Lasseter.
Yeah.
You're in class, I think, with Henry Selick. What led you to go there yourself? What were you kind of thinking about for your future?
A scholarship.
So
because it was an expensive school, and I think I was lucky at that time because, like you said, it was the start of the program, so they were a little bit more liberal, you know, at handing out scholarships, which is something that was like I needed that. I mean, and so I felt very grateful to kind of be able to. I like drawing. I didn't. you know, it's strange growing up in Burbank because, you know, like you said, it's the media, there's all the movie studios are there, but at the time it just felt like you could have been a million miles away. You know, there was no real, the only time that you sensed that it was Hollywood really is like sometimes you go down to the park and see them shooting Laughing or, you know, like yeah. guy falling over on a tricycle or, you know, whatever, like those old TV shows. Yeah. You had a little bit of a sense that there's something happening movie-wise or TV-wise, but at that time, it was very far removed in yeah. a strange way.
So at CalArts, you're essentially the equivalent of, you're asked to pick essentially a major. Why was yours character animation, which apparently was in a way looked down upon by some of the other people there? Why yeah. was that?
Well, that's because, again, the scholarship was through that. I mean, okay. Disney, I think what happened was that you know, the animators they had since, like, Snow White, they never really sort of taught new animators. So it was really the nine guys that were there from the beginning. Yeah. And so I think ultimately that's why the character animation program became a thing and they were giving out more scholarships is because it was a new program.
Got it.
And yeah, that was one.
So your style of drawing was not necessarily what other people imagined at Disney, or it wasn't like what was going on at Disney or other places. And this was evident even while you're at CalArts. What you've talked about a day, I believe, at a farmer's market where you just sort of had an epiphany. What happened?
Well, no, I was very frustrated because and even at Disney, you know, when I was working on things like Fox and the Hound, I mean, I was really bad at it, and it looked like roadkill, my foxes. And unfortunately, there wasn't a scene where they were hit by a car, so they needed a lot of work.
Right.
And I had, you know, I worked with this animator, Glenn Keane, who really took me under and sort of put up with my bad Disney style, and
that's once you leave CalArts to go to Disney.
Yeah. So, but in Farmer's Market, I just had this moment where I felt like I couldn't draw. I was frustrated, and I just sort of said, "I don't really care. I like drawing. I'm just going to draw however I want." And it really it was like a mind expanding experience. I never had that before, where I just all of a sudden started drawing in a different way, not better, not good. It just sort of was more me and. I'll never forget it. It happened in a second. And things like that don't usually happen like that.
Right. So at a certain point, you leave CalArts, I guess because a sort of silent animated short of yours caught the notice of Disney?
Yeah, well, I mean, what you would do at Disney, you know, you would do a piece of animation. You'd storyboard it, shoot it, edit it, do it all. And at the end of the year, Disney would come. And it was like kind of like being in the army. It's like, okay, we recruit. You know, they pick like a few different people mm-hmm. to go work at Disney. And not a lot, but like one or two or three. And it's like the second or third year I got picked. And, you know, I was having financial trouble. So I decided like, well, I'll just go, to, you know, get a job at Disney. Because I think for the character animators, I think that was sort of most of them, the goal is to work at Disney.
Right.
And so until they got there, then they changed their minds.
Well, that was sort of your experience, right? So you get there in 79. This is before, in the years sort of before Eisner and Katzenberg come in and revamp the place. And they're spending years on a project like Fox and the Hound that you mentioned.
Yeah.
And Cauldron.
There was like you said, from CalArts, there was an amazing group of animators, you know, John Lasseter, Brad Bird, John Musker. You know, the fact is, like, the success that they had, like, starting, I think it was probably, like, Little Mermaid, they could have had that 10, 20 years earlier, because there was this very, you know, artistic, hungry group of talented people that were just sort of languishing away. I mean, I think it's like John left to go do Pixar and other people did, you know. So it was a strange time at Disney when I was first there, because it was in transition for sure.
And Glenn Keane, who I think might still be there, was, you were essentially under him, right? And he you've talked about, here's the guy who's like the ultimate Disney kind of pro,
amazing.
Trying to work with you to do the Disney style.
Yeah, it was great. I mean, I still have amazing memory of what he put up with, yes.
But instead, they eventually, it seems like they recognize they have a very talented guy, but not in the traditional Disney vein. And so can you just explain how we wind up with you basically being given, I don't know what the word would be, almost like in-house sabbatical or something.
It was a straight, it was really, again, I don't think a studio ever was like that or would be like that again. Because I, you know, so I couldn't draw foxes. So then they go, well, so go draw, they were working on Black Cauldron. So I sat in a room for a year by myself, just drawing whatever I wanted to draw, which was incredible. I mean, really creatively. But I felt a bit like Rapunzel or something. I felt like, like I could do whatever I want, but to no one or to nobody. You know? So whatever these great things I was doing was like nothing. So, but at the same time, they had other projects going on. And so they go, oh, well, you know, maybe. So I did designs for lots of different projects that never really happened. But then, you know, like then they said, oh, we want to maybe do something with stop motion. And so they gave me like a little what they called development fund.
Which had been, though, a passion of yours, though, right? Since Ray Harryhausen.
Oh, like, No, so, I mean, I felt very, you know, so I got to do Vincent. Then I got to do Frankenweenie, you know. And sort of things that never really would have gotten done in an ordinary circumstance.
I just want to note for folks who may need a reminder or whatever, Vincent was, I think, a six-minute short that you made where you get your childhood sort of movie hero, Vincent Price, to come in and narrate it, and a kid who's, I think, seven wants to be Vincent Price. That sounds like Tim Burton might have been himself wanting to have been like Vincent Price at one point, right?
You know, I mean, he, you know, his movies acted almost like a psychologist, you know what I mean? Feeling alone and tormented and all of that, I go, yeah, I can relate to that. And so he, you know, like everybody has their kind of thing. And that for me, all those movies sort of psychologically helped me and kind of sort of guided me through my own twisted, you know, mental field.
Which, yeah.
So, and you know, when I sent him the thing, it was incredible because he just responded. I didn't know him or anything. So he responded, he got it, and, you know, he helped him actually get it made that way, you know.
And you obviously had there was mutual affection there because I know you made a documentary with him. He then comes back with Edward Scissorhands, which we'll talk about, and all kinds of things. But Vincent then gets followed by another sort of side project of yours, Frankenweenie, which again gets remade and expanded years later. But this idea here, just again for people who need a reminder, a kid revives his dead dog. You know, the sort of just...
Doesn't everybody's?
Yeah, right. But I think that... I think it's kind of interesting that there aren't too many examples in history where, you know, neither of these films, neither of these short films got seen very widely. And yet, the film that comes after them is Pee-wee's Big Adventure, your first feature as a director.
As I said, that was incredible. Like those short films that nobody saw, but like Paul Rubens and the producers and Warner saw it. So it was, you know, it was like what you would hope for. It was like a calling card, and actually getting my first feature was easier than getting my restaurant job at Sir George's Smorgasbord, which was weird. You know what I mean? I went through, so had to fill out more forms and do more checks and balances for that in my first feature, so whatever.
And just for the historical record, tell me if this any of this is wrong, but so Frankenweenie gets seen, I heard, by Stephen King? Is that right? Because Stephen King supposedly then tells Mark Canton, tells Mark Canton, who's the president of production at Warner Brothers, Mark Canton's looking for a guy to make a film with Paul Rubens, who we just lost earlier this year, but then through that, Paul Rubens watches Frankenweenie?
Yeah, no, I mean, like I said, I feel like with him, it's like if he didn't want me to make the movie, then I would, you know what I mean? So I was very lucky to have a few supporters, and from him, and then certain executives at the studio that were very supportive of me. And so, you know, I always remember those things. You know, I remember who in those times were very... you know, I hadn't done anything, you know. So those are the kind of people that are special to me.
And what's kind of amazing is your four Pee-wee, which, okay, it's a $7 million movie, I believe, grossed $41 million, essentially like a live-action cartoon, right? I mean, he's not like anyone else people had seen up to that point.
No.
And you put him in this world.
Depends on who you know.
Yeah,
you
right.
Know
what I mean? But you're just 26 or something, 28, for your first film, and yet, and it's very well received, as I say, $7 million cost, $41 million. Critics divided at the time it grew on people.
It was on some of the 10 worst films of the year. My first, that and Beetlejuice were on the 10 worst films of the year list.
People are catching up to you. It takes them a while.
But not many people can say that.
But here's the thing. For 3 years after Pee-wee, which had put you on the map in a big way, you're off the screen. There was not another film. What was going on during those years?
Well, I was offered a talking horse movie, which I turned down. And then, I don't know. It's weird. It's hard for me to account for my time. I don't know. I mean, I was trying to do things, but I don't know. I've been quite lucky. I've been very lucky to do things, but then people are always slightly concerned about me for some reason. I don't know. I don't really know why, but... So I've always had a strange relationship with Hollywood. You know, I feel blessed and grateful and lucky and then slightly tortured at the same time. So I don't really
So quite how understand. For the first film after Pee-wee do we end up with Beetlejuice? Yeah, well, which is first but certainly not last time working with Winona Ryder, Michael Keaton, and someone who we are very fortunate to have with us today in the room, Danny Elfman, your composer.
It was weird because, like, I used to go see Oingo Boingo before I even knew I'd ever be making films, and always thought music was quite cinematic and like movie stuff. So. Yeah, it was amazing for me to do like Pee-wee's Big Adventure and to see him do like Pee-wee's Big Adventure, which was in kind of a new, you know, big orchestra, all this kind of stuff. So it was quite, it felt like new and exciting, and seeing somebody like me on that just at a similar time doing the same kind of, with the same kind of weirdness.
And Danny has said, quote, "The only difference between us is that Tim's hero growing up was Vincent Price. Mine was Peter Lorre." So there is a similar...
Yeah. No, I mean, you know, people that like monster movies, there's a certain connection. With, right. You know,
but why the story Beetlejuice? Especially, it's interesting because, but for the actor strike, which came just like 2 days... if it had come 2 days later, you would be done with Beetlejuice 2, which we will get... Hopefully sooner than later.
If the strike is over. No, I got 2 days left. Two days.
But what was the root of the idea of this story about this eccentric group of folks that are at the center of Beetlejuice?
I think it was like what you were saying. It's like, Pee-wee surprised everybody. Then I struggled to kind of see where I was in Hollywood, and it was offered several things. But then Beetlejuice would seem like the strain. I couldn't believe that a studio wanted to do it, if you know what I mean. That's kind of why I wanted to do it, because it didn't follow kind of any real sort of trend in a way. And so that's why I kind of liked it. And then I got to work with all these people that were, you know, I kind of learned it from on Pee-wee's Big Adventure, all like people like Paul or Phil Hartman, the writer, and all these people who are good at improv. And I sort of saw that world. And then I got to work with like Michael and Catherine O'Hara, you know, people that were really good at improv. And so that excited me. And so it got into this vibe on Beetlejuice where there was a structure, but then we sort of kind of making up things as we kind of went along, which was, again, exciting to do. It did feel like kind of like an animated film in a certain way.
And at the end of Beetlejuice, just... for people keeping track at home, I believe we see for the first time at the very end, along with the merry-go-round situation, the first appearance of Jack Skellington, don't we? This is the...
I mean, I've been drawing that since I was a child. You know? In other words, those kind of things, they kind of come around and keep coming around. And
That's your...
I would draw something and then kind of... think about the character, rather than think about, I'm going to draw a character like this, a lot of it comes from the subconscious, which I always found was more important to me and more real.
Yeah. Okay, so now, a year after Beetlejuice, 1989, your biggest scale movie yet, let's just note, this was a $30 million 16 week of shooting across 9 sound stages, Batman. This is the first, I think, truly, you know, dark adaptation of a comic book, which is now the only way people do it. So you were at the forefront of that. But, you know, and you've talked about it being sort of, like most of your films, having an element of that you can personally tap into. I think you're saying it's essentially actually about depression, if you look at Batman in this or other things. But I guess I just wonder what your experience was on that one, to the extent that, you know, again, first time doing action, first time working on that size, to the point where you get physically sick. Right? Yeah.
Well, it was funny because we shot in London, and they never did this before or since. We shot 6 day weeks a whole time in the winter, so I didn't see daylight for like months. And yeah, and it was something I'll never do again. They won't do again because actually it was counterproductive. So it was, you know, it looked good on budget and on paper, but it was not. But it also felt, it was exciting because it did feel at the time new. You know, I mean, it did feel like, oh, you know, making these weird costumes and more like sort of darker and more psychological, even for one of those types of movies. So it did feel quite exciting. And we built sets. You know, we had the whole Pinewood to ourselves, so we had a big back lot. It was very exciting.
Hindsight, I mean, now people may not remember, but in the lead-up to the film, you guys were taking a lot of incoming fire. People are saying, you're going to put Michael Keaton.
Yeah, they thought it was going to be like Batman. Adam West. They thought it was going to be like that. And that's why I was happy to be in England, because it was before internet and stuff. So, I mean, we'd be killed now. Then, you know, it was still, but yeah, I mean, I was happy to be away and not hearing all of that sort of noise.
So just as in terms of throughout film history, you can look at certain directors and the 1-2-3 punch, like in terms of chronology. For you, I think there are a few that can stack up with 88 Beetlejuice, 89 Batman, and then 1990 Edward Scissorhands. And that's and of course, following Pee-wee was the first of them all a few years before. But your first three films, Pee-wee, Beetlejuice, Batman, all made when you're in your 20s, all made for big studio Warner Brothers, all kind of sleeper hits. People didn't think they would be as successful as they were, and then they were very successful. And now after that, when you think, no. you think that you would get some benefit from having a track record, and yet you go back to the same studio that made those three, Warner Brothers, and say, all right, here's what I want to do next. Edward Scissorhands. And they say, not interested.
No, why don't you? Fox is just down the street. but that's why I'm saying, you know, that's when people ask, but like my career is very, everybody thinks it's easier, but it never, it's always a struggle. I think that's just the nature of film. I mean, every film you do is a big thing, you know, and it's hard to mount it. It's hard to get all the people together, and it's hard to get the right, you know, elements. So, you know, I never expect things to get easy, or right. I never expect it to be that way because, I remember talking to them, and because they were talking to me about doing a third one, and like halfway through the meeting, I said to them, I go like, you guys don't want me to do another one, do you? And they go, no, but why don't you make another film like Edward Scissorhands, or like somewhere else? because I think after the second Batman, McDonald's got upset because they didn't understand what all the black stuff coming out of the Penguin's mouth or whatever kind of shit. I go, well,
you realize at that point it's getting a little corporate for you.
Does anybody know what goes into a Happy Meal? I mean, what's going on here?
Okay, but I don't want to gloss over Edward Scissorhands because this was such a great movie and moment for you, part not least because this was the first time of many now that you and Johnny Depp worked together. So it starts, correct me if any of this is wrong, but starts with a sketch of the character that you had done well before any script or even an idea of a script. You show that to Carolyn Thompson, who writes a script. And now This is a character with wild hair who dresses in black, is largely nonverbal, doesn't like and really can't touch other people, and is seen as an outsider by many in the suburb in which he resides. What possibly made you think of such a guy?
A lot of free time. Yeah. And honestly, that was, you know, I grew up with monster movies and fables, but that, for me, I always wanted to make something that I felt, and as a teenager, anytime, you know, I was just somebody that if, you know, went to hug me, I would flee. You know, I felt those things. And so in the spirit of like monster movies or fables, it's like, for me, it was something that was probably the most personal or one of the most personal things. And, you know, and it was strange to, you know, that's why it was hard to kind of talk to a studio. It's like, they don't really, at that time, the idea of doing a weird fable or whatever, what's a fable or fairy tale, you know? So it was something that was hard to get to. But again, doing it for a lower budget and doing it, you know, away from Warner Brothers, I guess, you know, it was just something that was easy, you know, it was something that meant a lot to me.
So we talk about this being a breakout moment for Johnny Depp, who up to that point was sort of teen idol from TV and whatever. The studio actually had wanted you to cast Tom Cruise, right?
Well, I mean, they always had lists of people. I mean, you know, they have lists of people. I don't think they do it as much anymore, but at the time, you know, they got this, you know, every student had a list, whether people were right or wrong for it, you know. So, yeah, I mean, I went through lots of periods where they, you know, it took a long time for actually people to say somebody like Johnny, you know, before. You know, he always sort of second or third on the list until a certain time in life. But that happens a lot. You know, that was very much of a Hollywood way of dealing with things.
Johnny said, quote, "Tim showed me several drawings of his Edward. I'd read the script, of course, but Tim's drawing said everything. I instantly fell for the character. He made his way into my body. I was traumatized by Tim's drawings. They haunted me." You guys also talked about him playing Edward like Lon Chaney, the silent movie.
Well, yeah, I mean, again, you know, it's like when you meet somebody who likes certain kind of movies like I did, there's a shorthand, you know what I mean? Because I wasn't a great communicator, I could communicate with certain people by showing a crude sketch, you know, and it's not, you could take these things literally because they don't look real. So I was always very grateful when somebody could see and get a feeling from a drawing rather than looking at it literally.
Right, because you
couldn't really connect the two. So that was a form of communication that I had with him, and I'm lucky with several other collaborators that could kind of read between the lines.
After that film was both Batman Returns, which you just referenced, and while you were directing that, you were also producing The Nightmare Before Christmas, which was, another one that I think, in a way, goes back to your days at Disney, right?
That was a long, I mean, you know, and when I first designed it, like, it was like 10 years before we actually got the production going. So it was something that I held out because, I went to lots of different publishers to make it a children's book, and then I went to people say, "Well, make it a TV show or TV." But I always held out for the stop motion because that was one of the reasons I wanted to do it. You know, growing up with Ray Harryhausen and certain stop motion things, like even the Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer. Yeah. I loved it. So that was always part of what it needed to be. So I resisted other forms of doing it, other forms of animation to sort of wait for the right time.
And then your old CalArts classmate, Henry Selick.
Yeah, no, he'd been doing some stop motion. You know, stop motion was not a big deal. You know, I mean, things like the Aardman's too, but it was a sort of a dying art. And so, you know, luckily, it's a very special kind of person that does stop motion. It's different than other forms. I mean, every form is great, but that was something that was very, very beautiful. And it takes a certain kind of patience, a certain kind of artistry, a certain kind of, I don't know, it's something really beautiful about the tactile nature of it. So, you know, it wouldn't have made it unless we could do it in stop motion. That was
and we'll note that you championed that with, okay, so you produced also later on James and the Giant Peach, co-directed and produced Corpse Bride, and produced Nine. So stop motion has been a running thing.
Yeah, no, like I said, the first movie I ever saw was like Jason the Argonauts, yeah. The Catalina Theater, you know, and I'll never forget the feeling of that. And once you get hooked by that, that's why. So people that love stop motion, it stays with you. Totally. It's a beautiful form.
So Ed Wood in 1994. This is a movie about quote unquote the worst director ever. Although I know you may beg to differ about that, but. Johnny Depp, who had barely spoken in Edward Scissorhands, now comes back as this unbelievably verbose guy in Ed Wood. And you've said that Johnny's inspiration, and I need you to explain this one to me because I find it very thought-provoking. Ronald Reagan?
Yeah, he's got strange influences, which, you know, I say I'm like this or that. He says, well, I go, whatever. You know what I mean? Everybody has their own weird. And sometimes they're, you know, he'll say Ronald Reagan or say Angela Lansbury and certain things. He'll say whatever. I think it's just whatever comes to his mind. That's right. Inspiration. Right. I don't know.
Now, there's a scene in Ed Wood that you've called your favorite in that film and one of your favorites in all of your films, when Ed Wood meets the woman who will become his wife. What can you take us into? Why is that scene so important to you?
Well, I just like the simplicity of it, you know. And I love the octopus scene. There's several scenes in it that I like, but it's something that I just like the simplicity of it. And I just like the idea of somebody accepting. You know, it's about acceptance and it's about people. And I just felt it was just a quiet, sort of beautiful moment. Yep. That was simple.
Martin Landau, by the way, wins Best Supporting Actor at the Oscars for Ed Wood. Late, great Martin Landau. 2 years later, just, I mean, if people are thinking about these as, you know, one and then the next one and then the next one, there's almost nothing in common from film to film because I think the next one is Mars Attacks.
Well, that's like an Ed Wood film, though, by the way.
Oh, you're saying Mars Attacks.
Yeah, that's my Ed Wood
that's
film.
That's your Ed Wood, yeah.
That's my Plan 9 from Outer Space.
Thing. With a lot of big stars, yeah. More than he would have
Everybody
got
Everybody wanted to be in Plan 9, but they couldn't, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Now, because Mars Attacks maybe wasn't received in the way that the studio may have wanted.
Well, that's why I moved to Europe, because it was very well received there. In fact, it was the most successful film I had done in Europe. Yeah.
But back here, was that the cause of why? Because you had been planning to do Superman and spent a lot of time prepping
about a year,
it.
Yeah.
Was that, do you think, derailed because of Mars Attacks?
Yeah, sure.
And was that was upsetting?
Well, no, because also too, like, I got the green light for Batman, like, they were, I was working on it a lot, but as soon as Beetlejuice came out, all of a sudden it got green lit. So I get, that's part of the way it goes. I mean, that's, you know, I accept that. And
sure.
I accepted it at the time. Yeah.
Back with Johnny in Sleepy Hollow, which you had sort of thought of as a silent movie almost at one point that when you first envisioned it, kind of an homage to the Hammer horror films that you'd grown up with.
Yeah.
You even put Christopher Lee in it.
Well, that was funny because at the time I go like, what? There's a little part, what about Christopher Lee? And the producer kept going like, he's dead. And I go, I didn't hear he died. No, he's dead. He's dead. And then many years later I saw him and I go, hey, it's funny, that dead guy, he went on to do 3 Star Wars and 4 Lord of the Rings. Pretty good for a dead
not
guy.
Not bad. Planet of the Apes, 2 years after that, this was the first revisitation of it. Now, you're making a face, but hold on.
I don't make faces, other people make faces.
This is 2001. You're remaking for the first Planet of the Apes since in years, right? Charlton Heston even makes a cameo. This is where you meet Helena Bonham Carter, right? Beginning of a collaboration there. Rick Baker makeup. A lot going for it, but then also the challenge of, like, sort of it sounds like what you ran into with Batman, where you sign on to a project and the budget is not necessarily locked and the script has to change. And talk about what it's like. I don't think you were any lesser of a director on that than you were on your others.
No. I think if I were to analyze it, which I don't really go back and do too much, but what I would say about that is that it was a strange thing. You're right. There was budget problems. There was this and that. And the thing is, I think it's a transition in terms of effects. It's like the things that they're doing now are it's all digital, and you know they're doing amazing things with it. But the reason I got interested was I love the old school of it. I love the idea of makeup and actors pretending to be apes. You know, I mean, to me that was funny and interesting. Yeah. But it wasn't really. You know, I think what they would have really liked is what they ended up doing next, which is kind of, you know, great digital animation and redefining it that way, which I get. So it was. I think it was at an awkward time, and I mean, there was lots of things I loved. I loved the people. I loved the cast. I was amazed by them going through all this makeup. You know, it was an incredible experience, and I, you know, it was difficult, but I enjoyed it. And I, like I said, I met a lot of great people.
20 years ago, almost exactly, was Big Fish, which is another movie that people love. The story of a guy trying to understand and maybe make peace with his father who's nearing the end. Some people suggested this is less Burton-esque, whatever that means, because they felt maybe it was a bit more sentimental. Not that that was a good or bad thing. That was just the way they... But you have said that... I mean, I believe that you may have lost your own father not long before. Was that coincidental?
Yeah. Well, no, I mean, I don't think I could have made that movie without having that experience. It's because it just brought up lots of things about what you know about people or don't know about people, even your own parents. And, like, I realized that when they were gone, I didn't really know anything about them, you know? And so there's always this mystery about who they were and what they, you know, what their lives were about. Because as children, even when you're old, you don't really think of your parents as people, you know? They're, like, they are, right. You know, but... It takes a long time to realize that they're people. And so that's, like I said, I think it really it hit me, and I was able to do that movie because I could feel those feelings.
One side note. Well, actually, one question and then one side note about Big Fish. Would Johnny Depp have been part of that were he not also doing Pirates of the Caribbean at that time, or was there just not a role?
I don't know. I mean, like, everybody goes, like with him or anybody I work with, I don't ever work with anybody just to work with him. I mean, it's like with Johnny or anybody, you know, it's like the part's got to be right. And, you know, so I never take that kind of it's always about the thing. And so, yeah, I mean, I don't know what else he was doing, but I think there's certain things that work and certain things.
Sure.
No.
The other side thing here is, the main character in Big Fish is named Edward Bloom. He follows in the footsteps of Edward Scissorhands and Ed Wood. What's with the Eds?
I don't know. I'm doing Mr. Ed next. Yeah, right. Talking horse picture. Finally. Thank you.
They finally got you. All right, so back with Johnny, Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, 2005. The same year that you do Corpse Bride and get nominated for an Oscar for the first time. I don't know what took them so long, but that was both 2005, 2007, back with Johnny again with Sweeney Todd. Now, I don't know how many people went into that one thinking, okay, so Johnny Depp's going to be singing, Tim Burton's going to want to do a Stephen Sondheim adaptation, but yet this was something that had been percolating in your mind for decades, right?
Well, I loved it. I mean, I didn't. You know, it was the only music I remember ever seeing that I loved. You know, when I saw it on stage, and so I never really had a desire. But it was scary because Stephen Sondheim. I mean, I'll never forget showing it to him, and I was terrified. But he, you know, he was very positive about it, and that meant a lot to me because it's quite complicated. And, you know, what he did was quite incredible. So it was a It was a strange thing, but it was beautiful. I loved doing it. I mean, again, it was, even though it was music, it was like that was truly like making a silent film, having music on the set, and it was.
You had like an 80-piece orchestra.
Yeah,
right?
It was great. It was beautiful.
back with Johnny again for Alice in Wonderland 2010, which only made $1 billion. That's not bad
for a movie that the critics hated, but it's good.
But you said that you had sort of a complex experience with that one, because I think in terms of you had not really worked with VFX in that way previously, right? Where
Yeah, but even that, we didn't do a technique. We didn't do like motion capture. It was really a mixture. It was like making let's make their eyes bigger. Let's make her head bigger. Let's do this and that. So it was really probably the most complicated film, because there was not one way of, in fact, hardly any of the characters were together. It was the strangest movie I ever made.
No previs or anything either, right? So you don't really know.
No, didn't do any of that.
Crazy. I will note.
Couldn't do that now.
No.
I'd be long.
We also have to acknowledge, I would like to acknowledge, that with us tonight is a four-time Oscar winner who won one of her Oscars for the costumes of that film, Colleen Atwood.
Oh, yeah.
So that's great to have her.
Yeah.
Congratulations. Yeah. One of your repeat collaborators.
No. And to be fair, I don't see great costumes. I wouldn't be wearing any clothes without her.
Do you remember what was the first?
Me.
What was the first film that you guys did together? Scissorhands. So this goes back to 1990. Wow. 2012, Dark Shadows, again with Johnny. And in a way, I wonder if a bit of you wouldn't have been thinking about this at the time, but was it for sort of practical purposes a bit of a test run for what you ended up doing with Wednesday, where you're working off of existing material but putting your own spin on it?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I didn't think of it that way. But yeah, I mean, I do things that are just based on whatever my personal weird thing. So yeah, I mean, I didn't think of it that way, but there's elements that I could, obviously, when I was doing it, I could feel it. And like with Wednesday, I love that character. So it wasn't really I wanted to do Adam's Family kind of thing, but the Alan Miles, they just wrote this thing, and I just, again, I identified with it. It reminded me of school, it reminded me of how I felt and the character. So, you know, that's what really drew me.
We're gonna dive into that a bit more in a moment. But first, the same year that you did Dark Shadows, you did the feature-length version of Frankenweenie, which you probably thought you would never touch again after the Disney year.
The only reason I wanted to do it, because the stop-motion thing, you know? I mean, it's like, because that was my original way to go kind of closer to the drawings and to kind of go back into that. So, yeah, now into shooting black and white, and it was beautiful. I mean, you know, for me, again, it's like when you if you ever visit a stop motion set, it's the most exciting, because it's like you build a whole set, and it's like when I was a kid playing with toys.
Yeah, whole world.
It was great.
2014, Big Eyes, back with the screenwriters of Ed Wood, Scott Alexander, and Larry Karaszewski. Another biopic, this time, though, focusing on a female, Margaret Keane, the artist. And I have to wonder, were you a Margaret Keane fan even before this? Because you have always had sort of big eyes at the center of your...
Well, I was like a kid, like everybody else, and was terrified of those things, you know? Very peaceful living room, like Big Brother, like these things, I mean, yeah. It's like, so it was very suburban, and like, I don't know when Burbank, that art was very much a part of my growing up in existence. So I think it was something that I was fascinated by art and fascinated by what people liked and how strangely, like, disturbing they were. So yeah, it fit into my...
That's great. Okay, so 2016, Miss Peregrine's Home for Peculiar Children, 2019, Dumbo, the full circle moment of you being the guy who Disney comes back to after all the history there for a live action version of that. And then it's time to now go more into your most recent and Emmy nominated work on Wednesday, which is one of the biggest hits in the history of Netflix, which has had some pretty largely heavily viewed shows. This is right up there with like the Squid Games and stuff like that. It's incredible how many people tuned in. Now, you had not done television in decades. What convinced you that this was something to go back to it for?
I like I said, when they wrote, it just spoke to me. I loved the character, had the worldview that I have. it was like reminding me of how I felt in school, how I feel about psychiatry, authority, everything. So it, for me, it was just, like I said, it felt like they had written it for me. And so it was, like I said, and then we were lucky to get, you know, because you can't, even with good writing or anything, you need to get the right person. So we were very lucky to get the right person.
Well, and that's what I've got to ask, because it was apparently a huge process to find Jenna Ortega. Can you take us through, like, how do you go about a search?
Well, it was during COVID, so we had to do everything by Zoom. So it was strange to cast the whole thing without, you know, we never met anybody until we were there. So it was a strange way of doing it. But it's like one of those kind of parts. You can have good actors, but they really have to inhabit that one. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah,
you can't say, "Oh, act kind of like stare," kind of ominously.
I understand you also were resistant to the idea of, you know, bringing in more CGI than was necessary. So we've got Thing, which you were saying, let's do it with the real
person. No, absolutely, because that's part of it. And, you know, we got a guy, who's like the Dustin Hoffman of hands, you know. He's like, wouldn't come out of his trailer and all that kind of shit. You know, it's like, all right, but just bring your hand out. You can stay in there, whatever. But but that's the fun of making something. You know what I mean? And again, on the new Beetlejuice, we're kind of reconnected to the fun of making films and the kind of handmade quality of it. And it's so, you know, it's fun experience when it's right for it. Yeah.
When you started to hear the numbers or the scale of the response to Wednesday, could you guys wrap your head around that?
I'm always surprised from the beginning of my career if something's popular or a failure or a success. Either one is, you know, could go either way.
right. Yeah. And will you, when our strikes are over and people can get back to work, will you be part of subsequent
when they can get back, whenever we can go back to work, I think there's a plan to do that, of course.
That's great.
Yeah.
With you directing some more episodes.
Yeah, I hope so.
Awesome.
Yeah, great.
Okay, in the very last 2 minutes here, I appreciate everybody's time and patience. We're gonna close here with just a few quick things. What's on your bucket list? Is there a genre that you haven't done, a story that you haven't told? Is there anything that you have been meaning to get to that you haven't yet gotten to?
No, I think there always is. But, you know, sometimes you work on, I got lots of problems, but I always feel like timing is important. And like, for instance, like you think something, Nightmare, it took 10 years from conception to actually the production getting started. And oftentimes that happens, you know, something, it seems like a good idea, then it's maybe refuses a bad idea, then maybe it's a good idea again. And so I always think there's stuff that's whirling around. But I think now, as I'm getting, I just want to kind of, it's always important to just do things that you really want to do, especially at this stage for me.
And that was sort of, I mean, Beetlejuice 2 must have been surreal to have some of these people from 35 years ago, Keaton, Winona, and then also Jenna Ortega. It must be like your whole life flashing.
No, yeah, it was, yeah. No, I felt like I was at my own funeral the whole time. It was great. No, it was really nice, and it was very special. You know, because like I said, it felt like it was very, very emotional.
Yeah.
Yes.
I'm sure that 35 years ago, you imagined that not only would you be making a sequel in 2023, 2024, but there would also be a musical version of Beetlejuice from which a United States congressman would be kicked out. I'm sure you predicted that one.
I wasn't even invited, so I don't know. Whatever.
Lastly, when you, I know, as you said, you don't often think back on what you've done over these years, but now that we forced you to do that, can you describe how, I mean, are you able to sort of step back and look at it objectively and say, this is pretty amazing how much has been packed in and what's been accomplished?
Well, it is strange when I'm just driving here, just driving down Hollywood Way near Victory, where I grew up. And so it is very, very strange and amazing to be here. Yeah. And that kind of makes you think about something where...
And being back in Burbank.
No, it's the Marriott's changed since I was a child.
Well, Tim Burton, thank you so much and congratulations.
Thank you for having me. Thank you so much. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Awards Chatter. We really appreciate it and would really appreciate you taking just a minute more to subscribe to the podcast and to leave us a rating and review on your podcast app. And to follow us on Twitter and Instagram, where our handle is @AwardsChatter. On those platforms, we announce upcoming guests and provide details about special live recordings of the podcast that you can attend. Until next time, thanks again for tuning in.